This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Around the world this weekend, thousands of people engaged in anti-war protests and vigils for peace. About 100,000 demonstrators marched on the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta on Sunday. In South Korea, some 30,000 workers gathered to demand that their National Assembly reject a bill dispatching 700 military engineers and medics to support the war. Even China, which traditionally forbids political protest of any sort, allowed several dozen students at Beijing University to put up anti-war signboards and pass out flyers to their classmates. Meanwhile, an estimated 300,000 people belonging to 19 political parties gathered in North Kolkata, India, holding signs reading "No War, we want peace" and "down with the imperial designs of the US-UK. In Mumbai, India, formerly known as Bombay, people's feelings about the war between the US and Iraq are based in India's long history of internal and external conflict. Peace Watch correspondent Jean Parker recently spoke with a cross-section of Indians in Mumbai about their views.
People in India have great respect for the international structures that have been established to settle conflicts between countries. They are incensed as much by the blatant disregard for the UN process as by the U.S. aggression itself. Suhas is a bank officer in Mumbai. He believes the U.S. should stick to the UN process, but that Iraq also needs to take positive steps to disarm.
The only solution to this problem is political. And if Uncle Sam comes forward for any political solution and stick to the UN resolution.
He continued by saying that the U.S. should get its own house in order first, before judging others. Across various sectors of society, people in India are urging restraint. Raman is 34 and a driver in Mumbai.
America பண்றது வந்து சரியில்லை but அவன சதேசன் பண்றதும் சரியில்லை ஏனா
the United States attacked Afghanistan with the support of Pakistan and they have given huge numbers of weapons and aeroplanes, fighter planes to Pakistan. So it's quite a distinct possibility that the United States could get the help of Pakistan to make war with India.
People are angry about the double standard they observe between the U.S. and the rest of the world. Here is Katen Kutari, an NGO administrator.
Americans have also acted like terrorists at certain times by supporting countries like Israel. I mean, if you want to disarm Iraq, why not disarm Israel also? Israel has actually got more weapons than Iraq at the present moment. So if you have this kind of rule, the rule should be uniformly applicable to everybody.
People here are categorically suspicious of Pakistan's motives for aligning with the U.S. war on terrorism. During the long-standing conflict between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, they have become accustomed to being on the brink of war. Again, here is Katen Kutari.
Pakistan, who is our neighbor, is the biggest hypocrite the world has ever seen because they have tried to perpetrate terrorism everywhere in the world that they possibly could, and at the same time, they are playing great hero for America's war against terrorism.
India's economy has suffered because of drought and worldwide instability. How this war will affect people on an everyday basis depends on their occupation, lifestyle, and location. Manju is a singer and music teacher.
See, economy gets disrupted. Everything becomes very costly, without reason. Cost of living rises so high that it becomes very difficult to comprehend why. The public transport, the private transport becomes unaffordable. You have to walk all along, waste a lot of time in doing that.
Mufazal, who is a student in Mumbai, explains that many people in India are more concerned with their daily survival than they are about U.S. problems with Iraq or Osama bin Laden. The average sweeper or lift operator seems oblivious to the pending catastrophe.
In general, there is so much ignorance in this country that really the basic needs of their day-to-day lives is what keeps the people preoccupied. The father of our nation, Mahatma Gandhi, he did not achieve independence for our country just so that we could get into war activity time and again.
Prime Minister Vajpayee expressed his opposition to an outside force imposing a regime change on another country. He did not specifically name the U.S. or Britain, and many here consider the government's position to be too weak. They are skeptical about the U.S. war on terrorism, and they empathize with ordinary Americans who are unemployed or who have lost their social benefits because of reallocations in domestic spending toward the military. But Manju, the music teacher, has something else to say.
Only one message I would give, especially to U.S., power comes and goes. Nothing remains for permanent. Everything is short-lived. So any destruction will always be remembered. Whatever Britishers have done to India, it's been always remembered.
For Peace Watch, I'm Jean Parker in Mumbai.
Closer to home, while the invasion of Iraq grinds on, the Bush administration is encouraging the American public to go on with their daily lives. However, people across the nation continue to voice their dissent, including taking part in protest actions where they risk arrest. In the nation's capital, early Friday morning, a group of global justice activists came together to say no to business-as-usual politics. Selena Musuta files this report.
Last Friday morning, downtown Washington, D.C. did not go on with business as usual. Around 7 a.m., 13 protesters decided to put their bodies on the line and shut down the intersection of Pennsylvania and 14th Street in order to raise awareness of the disruption that war causes. While they locked themselves down, many of their supporters participated in a political circus that was to symbolically demonstrate the mockery that the government and media have taken part in this war on Iraq. Andrew Willis, one of the 13 who blocked the streets, discusses the reasons why he participated in this lockdown.
Today, I'm locking down in the street here with 12 of my comrades and friends, and to let the administration know that we're not going anywhere. As long as they're in Iraq, and you know, we're going to stay here until our regime has changed too.
Joseph Pruno discusses creative ways in which he and others chose to protest.
We are part of the peace movement. And we are creating improvisational street theater in order to support the lockdown. We are calling ourselves the Cirque de Deceit, the greatest sham on earth, brought to you by the Bush administration. We have the clown Congress jumping through hoops. We have the magician Shidini, who pulls money out of the hat, money that was not there for health care, for housing, for improved education, but all of a sudden is there for war. We have the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, walking high above the three-ring circus on the high wire, and he is walking a very fine line indeed between moral certitude and certain failure, and there's no net below, but perhaps George Bush will catch him.
20-year-old American University student Elizabeth explains why she decided to support the lockdown.
I'm really frustrated. I feel like the democratic process is being completely overridden. I think that such a voice of opposition should not be ignored and considered a focus group. I think that our Congress is failing to address this issue in any kind of real way. I worry about the economic conditions that are going to be affected by billions of dollars going towards this war. But I am hopeful that the anti-war movement, it's grown a lot, it's really strong, it's really diverse, and so at least I feel like there'll be someone to continue pressuring this administration and this government to make more responsible decisions in the future, even though we were unable to prevent this war. As far as protesting after the war has begun, I think it's really important for a couple reasons. This war is still unjustified and wrong, and I don't think that we should stop saying that just because they didn't listen the first time. I worry about this administration as an aggressive one, that this isn't the last country, just the idea of an axis of evil and multiple countries that we consider a threat. So I worry that this administration will continue this kind of action in the next 2 years. And so it's important for us to keep the pressure on them and show how much opposition this war has and how we refuse to stop and the effect that will happen if they attempt another war like this.
As some people walked by without uttering a sound and others jeered, Reuben Jackson, a mentor for some of D.C.'s youth, stayed as a witness to what was happening on the streets.
I was on my way to work. I work down the street here at the Smithsonian. This is more important to me than anything. I think that as a nation, we are consciously not struggling with years and years of greed and arrogance and racism. And I think the current regime is just an overt manifestation of that. And those of us who have any love of, I don't want to say democracy, because I don't think that's existed yet on this planet, but fairness, justice, have to speak up, whether it's with physical presence or civil disobedience. We have to express it in some way. I think it's more crucial than ever.
This is Selena Masuta reporting for Peace Watch.
Later this week, Congress will debate President Bush's supplemental budget to fund the spiraling cost of the war on Iraq. Bush is asking for $75 billion, but estimates by independent economists of the cost of the war have ranged from $100 million to as high as $1.6 trillion in the worst-case scenario. This concerns Texas Democratic Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, who spoke on the floor of the House of Representatives last week about the domestic cost of war.
It is key that we recognize that we may have to sacrifice to rebuild a nation that we're now at war with. I know Americans are caring people, and so I know Americans would want to be on the front lines of helping those children and those families in Iraq. But, Mr. Speaker, we cannot do it with $726 billion tax cut. An increasing amount of dollars for the war. We cannot do it with the budget that has been presented by the president or the budget that has been passed by this House by one vote. We cannot do this to our veterans, who clearly deserve better than a 28% cut in their budget, and as well the door being closed at veterans' hospitals on a daily basis. These are veterans who are parents of young children. And so, Mr. Speaker, I would simply say that we have a lot of work to do if we care about our children. It is, if you will, a disappointment that we would offer this budget and this approach to America and the world. I am disappointed that the president's budget raises spending on international affairs by substantially more than inflation, but the cut to domestic appropriations must be $129 billion. And might I balance my remarks, Mr. Speaker, because I support our work internationally. I believe it is important to gain friends. It is certainly a crisis when we see that over 10 years, $244 billion in domestic discretionary spending is going out the window. You know what that means, Mr. Speaker? It means the CHIPS program, the Children's Health Insurance Program, that's what's going out. It means that Medicaid for children who need mental health services is going out. It's coming right when our states are hurting, governors are hurting, cities are hurting. It's extremely important. And so I would ask that my colleagues listen as we move toward designing the emergency supplemental. That's the appropriations that would include funding for the war. The Republican budget requires $265 billion in cuts to public benefits. As I said, veterans benefits, Medicaid, Medicare. The cuts are likely to hit veterans programs, loans for college students, school lunch programs, Medicaid, pensions for federal employees and railroad employees, and agricultural programs. Pell grants are being cut, colleges are being cut, school lunch programs are in jeopardy, and yes, loans for our college students. What is our concern for the children? Mr. Speaker, I would offer to say to you, we can do better. I believe that we have to be responsible in investing in our children and investing in America's domestic tranquility. And that's one of my underlying themes. We are always ready to put out the fire. I'd like to make sure we don't have a fire. And we all ran to put out the Enron fire. Lo and behold, the collapse of corporate integrity, one of the largest bankruptcies that we've ever seen, and the laying off of thousands of my constituents who were impacted, and they impacted the children that they were responsible for. The Democratic plan will create about twice as many jobs as the president's budget and the Republican budget, according to mainstream economic forecasting models, while costing less than one-sixth as much over the long term. Democrats provide an immediate $136 billion in tax cuts as opposed to $726. That's what you call mutual sacrifice, and it is a stimulus of which we will immediately see. I believe that we have harmed the domestic tranquility. We have failed our senior citizens by not yet moving on a guaranteed, robust prescription drug plan. And so, Mr. Speaker, I think that we need to begin to look constructively at how we can help the children. The Republicans cut 2004 appropriations for the Department of Education by $1.4 billion, 2.7%, below the 2003 enacted level. However, because the Republicans matched the president's funding for several No Child Behind Act programs, their across-the-board cut reduces all the education programs by 10.2% below the president's levels and by 8.3% below the 2003 enacted programs. So let me give you an example, Mr. Speaker. Tremendous cuts to safe and drug-free schools, after-school programs, education for homeless children, vocational education, and aid to historically black colleges and universities and other programs. How does that hit home? It hit home, Mr. Speaker, in the course and manner of real people. Our school districts are not celebrating that you're cutting their safe and drug-free schools because, Mr. Speaker, some of them have been able to access those dollars to help them in their homeland security needs. And so to cut the safe and drug-free schools just puts the responsibility or the burden on the local districts and their dwindling tax base and gives the United States government another free ride.
U.S. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas. Well, as the Pentagon calls up more troops to defend its supply lines in Iraq, military recruiters back at home are working to ensure a fresh supply of young Americans for the so-called war on terrorism. The president's No Child Left Behind education plan has given recruiters unprecedented access to America's youth. Peace Watch contributor Josh Chaffin has this look at some of the controversies the recruiters bring with them into American high schools.
It's military information night at a public high school in Virginia, a wooded suburb of Washington, D.C. School's been out for hours and baseball practice is over. Four or five school employees in sweaters and slacks smile at the visitors as they come into one of the multi-purpose rooms, fresh-faced teens and their parents looking at military careers. Recruiters from all the branches of the military line up in front of the room in uniform, the Marines, the Army, the Air Force, the National Guard, some of them just a year or two older than the kids they're recruiting. They're handing out bumper stickers and thick brochures with names like Opportunities for Minorities in the officer ranks. Some of the recruiters have borrowed school TVs so they can show videos of great ships cutting through hostile seas, fighter planes landing on the deck. The school says I can't interview any of the guests, but out behind the school, in the freezing cold, I talked to a young woman who works with a network of anti-war teenagers in the D.C. area.
When the military recruiters were at my school a few months ago, I saw firsthand how they say stuff which just isn't true at all.
At 17 years old, she knows more about U.S. foreign policy than most adults I know, and she's already been arrested for civil disobedience, something her parents, whom she calls traditional liberals, just hate. She's already in pretty deep with the administration at her school, so we'll just call her Mary for the sake of this story. Mary's been showing up to recruiting events at area schools and handing out flyers about the military. She says recruiters tell kids if they don't like the service, they can get out after a provisional period of 6 months.
I asked them specifically, if I signed up but then I decided I didn't want to go into the military after 6 months, could I get out? And they were saying, oh yeah, you can get out, that won't be a problem. But in reality, that delayed period just doesn't exist.
Nobody's out there on the front lines just doing their own thing to make goal and do that in an unethical or illegal manner.
How do I identify you on tape, Lieutenant?
Lieutenant Bill Davis, Navy Recruiting Command Deputy Public Affairs Officer. We've got 31 districts nationwide who run those 1,400 stations, who in turn run those 4,400 Navy recruiters that we have out there. So there's a chain in command that they must adhere to.
Mary says recruiters lie, and Lieutenant Davis says they don't. So where do I turn? Well, when I was a kid, my friend Andrei Kazanov was always obsessed with military history. He knew a lot more than most kids about world politics. He was always building these detailed models of old military airplanes. One birthday, his mom got him a cake that was shaped like a World War II bomber. When I was a senior in high school, Andre went to the Navy. I called him to see if he'd ever heard this myth about the six-month provisional period.
I heard that one. Yeah, you can get out. You're going to get out on, at the very least, on other than honorable discharge. If they get a dishonorable discharge, they can't get a job at McDonald's or Taco Bell or Burger King. Yeah, I remember hearing that one.
From the recruiter, you mean?
Yeah.
Another one of, Mary, the anti-war high school kids' contentions about the military is that they tell you they'll give you all these high-tech skills that'll help you in the job market, and then they don't. My friend Andre concurred.
When I get to my final duty station, the equipment I was working on had vacuum tubes in it. There wasn't, you know, too many places where, you know, I'm going to go and say, hey, I got, you know, 3 or 4 years of vacuum tube electronics experience. You know, you get laughed out of some places.
Again, Lieutenant Davis with the Navy Recruiting Command.
The majority of sailors will receive a tangible training skill that they can take with them and translate that right into the civilian sector. Let's take the air traffic controller, for example. He goes in, gets the training as an air traffic controller. Not a whole lot different, necessarily, on the civilian side.
The No Child Left Behind Act, the Bush education plan, was more than 600 pages long. In there somewhere was a provision giving military recruiters more access to schools than they used to have. Out in the cold in the back of that Virginia high school, Mary told me that if schools don't comply, they can lose their federal funding.
All these schools have to turn over all the personal information that they have on students. And it's not like where you have to sign up to have this turned over. It's that if you don't sign out of it, it will be turned over. And a lot of times it's not really publicized that you can opt out of it. And basically, if the schools fail to do this, they'll lose federal funding and accreditation, which is obviously something these school districts that are severely in debt right now aren't going to risk.
The San Francisco Public School District has taken to sending home letters informing kids that they have to opt out if they don't want their personal information sent to the Pentagon. But that may be the only district in the country doing that. One of the many high schools which does turn over students' contact information to recruiters is called, well, I can't tell you what it's called because this next guy is a teacher there and he doesn't want his name used because he's worried about his job.
In the two experiences I've had in recent weeks with recruiters going into my classroom, that being Air Force and Navy, the word patriotism has not been mentioned one time. It's because patriotism is not what is going to lure 16, 17, 14-year-olds to join the military.
Wait, so if they're not using patriotism to get people in, what are they using?
Cash. The cash that can be made to traveling. Now, I'll give you a quote here. The Navy recruiter said, "Believe it or not, my favorite place in the world is Mexico. They have lots of good-looking women and lots of beer." It's a small crime to go into classrooms using that as a selling point. If you were to ask a professional athlete, if you were to call Chris Webber or Kobe Bryant to the class, the last thing they would do is talk about the joys of alcohol.
An online research project called IraqBodyCount.net reports today that somewhere between 450 and 560 Iraqi non-combatants have died in 12 days of fighting.
They do not mention anything about killing people, being killed. In fact, the Navy recruiter said, all you do sometimes is push a button and send off missiles. Some sort of mention of where those missiles land, it's of significance. The possibility of being killed at war was never mentioned, which gives a skewed idea of war. They're talking about a career that involves something as serious as killing and dying. And when you're talking to a 16, 15, 14-year-old, the omission of necessary facts is not questioned because he or she is not savvy enough to come to his or her own conclusions on it.
The Department of Education budget for 2003 is somewhere in the area of $60 billion. The defense budget is about $400 billion, not counting the cost of war with Iraq. For Peace Watch, I'm Josh Chaffin.
Thousands of artists, musicians, actors, and writers have signed up for Waging the Peace in the midst of this bloody war. Amongst them, freelance writer Patrice Gaines, who offers this expression of gratitude to the peacemakers of the world.
For the Peacemakers by Patrice Gaines, dedicated to Damu Smith. Peace-filled people bake cookies, laugh, love, blow bubbles, pet dogs that belong to strangers, commit random acts of kindness, put their hands over the bloody wounds of soldiers and soak up all hatred and pain. Peace-filled people put their hands over their hearts and pledge allegiance to God, Spirit, Jehovah, Allah, to the no-name God, to Jesus the Christ, to the Buddha and Krishna and Creator whom they have named, and they know that all of these are the same. Peace-filled people are full of patience and forgiveness because they understand there is no such thing as a minute, an hour, or a day, but there is only the now. There is only love. Peace-filled people will love a new world into existence because in the beginning there was the Word, and the Word was peace, and in the now there is the Word, and the Word must be peace, or we will see the end written in the tears of the Spirit Jehovah Allah. In the quiet of our hearts, there is peace everlasting. Under the skin, that is an illusion that we have come to believe in. But you who are of peace, cultivate the knowing seeds of the heart and go below the surface to read between the lines, to feel the truth and stand on it. Blessed are those who keep the peace, for they shall save the earth. Doves will fly from your mouth, thick trees will sprout from your head, light will shoot from your hearts. Peace-filled people cover the wounds of soldiers with their hands and stop the bombs. Wash blood away with love, fill your temple with peace. Let the doves fly from your mouth, march softly on the earth in protest of the mighty thunder of war. Know the truth. If a bomb explodes 60 miles off the coast of Florida and no one hears it, does it cause any harm? Ask the whales in the Atlantic. Ask the porpoises who have tried to warn us all along. Ask the algae that has survived Hiroshima and Exxon. Ask the wind that has to carry the horrors of man from continent to continent. Ask God, Jehovah, Buddha, great Allah, and listen. Unlike the Texas cowboys, listen. It will be the peacemaker who will hear. It is the peacemakers who will have to whisper the answer loudly. March on the earth softly. Help the wind carry the warning that man is about to harm himself again. Oh, praises to the peacemaker. Without you, what earth would there be to inherit? Oh, praises to the peacemaker, for you shall save the earth. Peace, be still. Peace. Be still. Peace, be still. It's you.
It's you. Patrice Gaines is a former writer for the Washington Post and author of Laughing in the Dark. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett of KPFA, Avishay Artsy, and Mike Aloney. Thanks to Pete Karakas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening. It's you.